This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to our 20th annual Writers Symposium by the Sea at Point Loma Nazarene University. I'm Dean Nelson. I'm the journalism faculty at the university. And tonight we have the privilege of having the great short story writer Leslie Tenorio with us. Leslie's stories have appeared in The Atlantic, in Plowshares, in New American Voices, and many other reviews and magazines and anthologies. He's been awarded fellowships at Stanford, the University of Wisconsin, Phillips Exeter Academy, and about 500 other places, including the National Endowment for the Arts. His collection of short stories, right here, Monstrous, was the one book won San Diego selection this year. Now he teaches writing at St. Mary's College in San Francisco. Leslie Tenorio, welcome to our Writers Symposium.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It's fun to be here.
And I should say, welcome home.
Yep.
You grew up in this area.
I grew up in Mira Mesa.
Mira Mesa. I loved hearing that you said that you spent some time at the Mira Mesa Public Library when you were a little kid.
A lot of time. Every Wednesday in elementary school, Wednesday was half day. And so my father would pick me up and take me to the library to pick my books out for the week. So that was, I think, where I really started enjoying reading and realizing that books were a kind of escape and just kind of a refuge from, you know, daily boredom or whatever stresses an 8-year-old could possibly be suffering from at
that time. Yeah, what were those stresses?
Oh, gosh,
at 8?
Hamster crisis and
exactly.
Things like that.
Exactly. Yeah, that just goes across all sorts of class, gender,
right.
Racial
issues. It's universal.
Issues. Yeah, it is a universal.
Yeah.
And you were able to visit your old high school?
Yeah.
While you've been here?
I went to my old high school. I went to Mira Mesa High School yesterday. I hadn't stepped foot on campus for 25 years. It had been a long time. And it was quite an experience. Everything seems smaller. It feels as though they shrunk the campus somehow. But I got to meet with some students and my favorite English teacher from 10th grade who'd retired like 15 years before even showed up.
How
and
cool.
remembered me and had read the book. And so it was great to see someone who'd helped cultivate the love of reading and writing.
Yeah,
you know, at this event where I was there to talk about my book. So
very cool.
Yeah.
Do you remember going back to the library for a minute? Do you remember what some of those early books were that really got your attention when you were little?
Yes, the Beverly Cleary books, Ramona the Pest, Pieces of Ramona, some Judy Blume, like Tales of the Fourth. Not the scandalous ones, like Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret, or Tiger Eyes. I never read those.
You said on the safe side of her.
Yeah, Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing. And then, you know, books like From the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler, the young brother and sister who run away to live in the Metropolitan Museum of Art. Books like that, just, I mean, they're so vivid to me in my mind even now.
How cool.
Yeah.
Well, all right. And I'm remembering, I read somewhere that you were born in the Philippines during an earthquake?
That's what I'm told. I was told that I was...
You don't remember?
I don't remember. And you know, it's not on film. I was told that I was born during an earthquake. And this is the story I've been told by my mother and older siblings. I was born during an earthquake. I think there's a story, maybe they were just joking, I didn't realize it, but their story was that I might have even been named the Tagalog word for earthquake, which was Lindol, so my name would have been Lindol, but they went with a very strangely spelled Leslie instead.
Wow. But that's some early legacy, though, for you to be born during an
earthquake. Yeah, it's a lot to live up to, earthquake,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
I thought it was interesting that also, when I was reading about you, that you didn't take writing all that seriously until maybe your senior year of college?
Yeah, that's right.
Is that correct? So
that's
you're not
right.
One of these 8-year-olds who, you know, was writing, you know, books.
Yeah.
And
yeah, I wasn't a whiz kid or a literary Doogie Howser. You know, I really, I mean, I always liked to read. Mm-hmm. And I was good at writing essays in high school. But when I was in college, I didn't have a strong sense of direction, which I appreciate now. I went to school at UC Berkeley. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I knew that I was pretty good at English, so I took English classes. And once I went further into the major, I thought I would go the more academic route and teach. But I ended up taking a short story class with an Indian American writer named Bharati Mukherjee. And I decided to look at her books. I figured if I was going to be studying with her, I would see what she'd written. And she wrote a collection of stories called The Middleman and Other Stories. And it was the first time that I'd seen I guess you'd want to call it contemporary immigrant life portrayed in that way in this book of stories. It was just, very unsentimental and very sharp. And I admired, I especially admired how she was willing to write from the points of view of people who were completely different from herself.
They weren't all from an Indian heritage?
Some of them were. But I remember she had Filipino characters in there, Trinidadian characters. Hmm. She wrote from the point of view of a Vietnam vet. And that kind of daring was something I wanted to try to take on. I had no sense if I'd be any good at it or not. And frankly, those first stories I wrote were quite terrible.
In fact, you called them, at one point, you called them Immigrant of the Week
Immigrant stories? Tragedies of the Week.
Immigrant Tragedies.
Yeah, like those Lifetime movies of the week. It was always some immigrant family with a dark secret revealed, like on three pages to the end. Quite formulaic and quite cheesy, but it at least gave
That's what
me
you the, did early on.
That was the early stuff.
Right.
Yeah, but I realized soon that that was the only class that I was losing sleep over. You take a creative writing class, for the most part, if you do the work and you put in your effort, you got a good grade. So I wasn't worried about the grade. I was worried about the quality of the work. So I remember I would lie in bed trying to fall asleep, and 2 in the morning I would think, whoa, that's a really terrible paragraph that's on page 8. And I'll be mortified if anyone were to read that. So I would get up out of bed and just retype it. And I thought, if this is something I'm losing sleep over, then it must be something I care about. And again, I didn't know if I was any good at it or not, but because I cared about it so much, I knew that I had to make it an integral part of my life. And I didn't know how I would do that at the time, but I knew that I had to.
So this wasn't like some light, shaft of light that came from the sky that said, Leslie, be a writer.
No.
This was, it just sort of started dawning on you while you were taking this class.
Yeah, it did. And even after I graduated, from college, I got a job, like a 9-to-5 job for about a year and a half. Had a cubicle at an internet company in the early days of the internet. We were called World Wide Web Inc. I used to answer
the
phone,
and
people would say, are you the internet? And I would say, no, I'm not the internet, but this is World Wide Web, Inc. This is like 90. I'm dating myself. This is 96, 95, 96. I knew I didn't want to do that the rest of my life. And I found out that you could go to graduate school for creative writing for 2 years, like a 2-year program. And I thought, that sounds like writing camp. I never did summer camp as a kid, but I thought 2 years just to write your fiction sounds like a lot of fun to me. And so I decided, I remember I even told myself, apply just this year. And if you never get in, you never have to try again. You can say at least you tried. And I'm not at all saying that you need to go to graduate school to be a writer. Obviously you don't. But for me, I needed that kind of structure and environment. And so I applied to some schools and got into a couple and then ended up going to the University of Oregon in Eugene for 2 years. I'd never lived outside California before. And so for me anyway, that was this. Suddenly to find yourself not in California was quite an experience.
Yeah, and to just be writing.
Yeah. I mean, you took your more academic courses, but it was really about the writing. I mean, I was writing constantly, and I was such a little speed demon back then. I was a lot younger, but I remember there were nights where I could push out a 20-page story like in one night or two nights and just stay up all night and do it. And I don't have the stamina for that anymore, but I did then.
Were you doing short story?
Yes. Yes, the whole time.
Okay. All right. Now, you had some early success. One of the stories, I'm absolutely amazed at how you got your first story published in The Atlantic.
Yeah.
You just sent it in. You didn't have an agent.
No.
You didn't know an editor.
No.
You wrote a story and sent it to The Atlantic.
Yeah.
And some, for all we know, some intern pulled it out of a pile and showed it to an editor and said, this is pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah.
You realize that's just so annoying to the rest of us?
I was very lucky, and maybe I was just very naive. I didn't know.
It worked, though, didn't it?
It worked. It worked, yeah. The Atlantic, they publish, it's one of the venues that's been publishing fiction for decades. I don't know, maybe a century at this point.
Yeah, I'd say more than 100 years.
And, you know, it's the slush pile, if you don't know. The slush pile is where your submissions end up if you aren't an established writer with an agent. So a slush pile, the Atlantic at that time averaged about 2,000 stories a month they would receive. Mm-hmm. Somehow someone pulled me from the slush pile and published that story. And that was my first publication. And I foolishly thought, oh, well, if it's this easy, I'll just send a story a month to the Atlantic and just publish and, you know, finish a book in a year. And I was completely wrong.
Yeah, how'd that work out for you?
Not well at all.
In fact, early success can actually be a curse.
Mm-hmm.
I think of Annie Dillard, for instance, right off the bat.
Yeah.
Has this wild success and then has this struggle to kind of live up to that. It took a few years, didn't it, for you to get something else accepted by the Atlantic or whomever?
Yeah, that first year when I started sending out work, I managed to sell two stories. One was in the Atlantic and one is Plowshares, which is another one of the more prominent venues for short fiction. Mm-hmm. But it was another, I don't know, 2 or 3 years before I sold another story. And I realized, you know, it's... For some writers, it's a long process. I wish that I could write more quickly, and I wish that I could write more decisively. But as I'm writing, I'm also editing in my head. So as you move forward, there's also a lot of backtracking. It becomes a very, you know, for all the moments of inspiration and the fun that writing can be, it's incredibly labor intensive. It just feels like you're working with these blocks or these bricks and constantly arranging them in a big way, but also in a very, very small, you know, very fine-tuned way. And especially once I started writing on my own outside of school, I realized, oh boy, this is a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And I don't think anyone told me it was going to be this hard.
Well, okay, and you weren't getting much payoff from it. You weren't getting the attention you thought you were going to get, yeah, especially after that first time. So what made you keep at it?
I mean, I was lucky to continue to get support in many ways. So after graduate school, I did about 4 years of fellowships. And a writing fellowship, there are different kinds, but essentially when a writer says he or she is on fellowship, you sometimes move to a school that will give you funding while you work on your book. Maybe you teach a class or two. So I moved to New Hampshire. I found myself living at this very elite New England boarding school where I was just the writer in residence. I'd never been to New England before, but there I was living in New England alone, you know, by myself.
But you fit right in, didn't you?
Oh, yeah, totally fit right in. Then I moved to Wisconsin, and then I was able to come back to California. I got a 2-year fellowship at Stanford. So being in that community of other writers was always, it was always a good kind of pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And also, whenever you get any kind of support, what you're really getting is an investment. If there are people out, not that a writer needs this, but if there are individuals or institutions who want to invest in your work, that's a sign that they believe in it, that they believe mm-hmm. this is worthy of being out there. And because I felt that's what was happening to me, I felt this obligation to keep writing. Obviously, the only real obligation is to myself, of course. But I felt like, well, if I have the support, if there are other people who believe in the work, it's worth continuing and it's worth plugging away, even though many of those days or months or even years can seem quite thankless with very little payoff. But you keep doing it.
It's interesting as a writer, though, you don't need very much incentive. You just need a little something, somebody to acknowledge this is worth it.
Yes. Yeah.
And even though it might not be getting published, at least a fellowship or some kind of encouragement moves you a little further down the road.
Yeah, that's how it was for me. Because I don't consider myself, I mean, who knows what this means, but I don't know that I am a natural writer. I don't know that I wake up and I just naturally gravitate to pen and paper. There are some days there are a million things I would rather do the dishes than write sometimes, you know. But when I finally force myself to the desk, when I'm at the keyboard or, you know, working with pen and paper, and let's say I just nail that paragraph, or I get that sentence right that has been troubling me for 2 days prior, it feels like the small victory. You will kind of want to do the touchdown, the football touchdown dance. Is that the sport where they do? I don't know sports. You kind of just want to high five the air. Mm-hmm. And that's, for me, that's what keeps me going.
Yeah. So then you say, okay, it's worth it.
Yes.
Got it. I think it's interesting also that you discovered eventually that the combination of funny, sad, and beautiful worked for you, for the stories that you were working on. And I want to know, how did you come to that conclusion?
Funny, sad, and beautiful.
That was a quote from an interview that you
really
did a long time ago.
Gosh.
Yeah, I'm quoting you.
Did I lie? hope I didn't lie. Oh, I knew you were using my words against me.
Yeah.
I think funny, sad, and beautiful are things that I aspire. You know, those are things I aspire to reach in the work. I like funny. If I have to sit down and work with a set of characters or a particular plot for X number of hours a day, I want to at least be entertained. So if I can give myself a set of circumstances that on the surface seem funny, I'll at least be entertained. So, for example, I have a story about these guys who beat up the Beatles in the Philippines, and it's a true story. The Beatles really were beat up in the Philippines.
And it really is a funny story.
I hope it's a funny
story. The way you do it, it's very funny.
I hope it's funny. And so I liked this idea of, on the surface, you have this kind of outlandish, whimsical trajectory of events that, as a writer, I am interested in, and hopefully a reader is too. But I also don't want to write fiction for the sake of telling a joke. That's not my job. My job is to try to illuminate various possible truths in a given narrative. And so I want to find the polar opposite of that, which is sadness and melancholy. So I like the challenge of trying to take something that seems funny on the surface, but maybe quietly sad or even quietly tragic. And if you can relay that in language that is hopefully, without being too precious, beautiful as well, so that you can take a moment from a zany situation like that and identify a real moment of beauty or even grace for what might seem like a silly set of characters, to me, that's a feat for mm-hmm. me. Mm-hmm. It's a challenge. And hopefully it's true. Hopefully that's what life is. Hopefully life is funny and it's sad and it's beautiful and it's ugly. People often ask me about this book, why are all the endings so sad? And to
some
me...
Some of them are crushingly
yeah,
sad.
Yeah, they're kind of a... Yeah,
some
are downers.
Of them are.
But I feel like that's... To me, they're always complex. In life, in fiction, as in life, no one is a pure winner. No one is a pure loser. No one is purely happy. No one is purely sad. It's the mix of those things, and that's what I'm striving to render on the page.
Yeah, so you're not starting out, okay, I want to write a story now that's funny, sad, and beautiful.
No.
You're just doing a story. But I think that's one of the common descriptions that mm-hmm. that has come out of your work, that they are all of the... I think all of your stories have all those dimensions in them. But it's interesting. You don't start out that way.
I start out, what is the story here? What is the beginning? What is the middle end? Who are the individuals who would find themselves within this dramatic space? And how do I make them believable? And how do I make them interesting? And how do I make them complex?
You know, we've talked about some of your early influences, whether it was at the library or your creative writing teacher at Berkeley. But I also found out that some of your early influences include Buffy the Vampire Slayer.
Ah, man.
Seriously?
I shouldn't say these things in public.
Buffy the Vampire
yes,
Slayer.
I
got to know.
Well,
and the Carpenters.
And the Carpenters.
So you got to explain this.
Okay. I think maybe I was drinking during that interview. I don't know. I think, there's this sense of when you're writing what might be called literary fiction, mm-hmm. there's this sense of highbrow.
Hold. What is that? What is literary fiction? How is that different from fiction?
Literary fiction, in my understanding, and it really is a category, and I think it's a category that allows for like a business type shorthand. Here's work by someone like Toni Morrison that is complex, and I'm not comparing myself to Toni Morrison, but here's work by Toni Morrison that is complex and layered and is concerned with language and is meant to be emotionally as well as intellectually substantial. On the other shelves, you have the spy thriller that's just for fun.
Mm-hmm.
All you just want to get immersed. You don't necessarily need to write an essay, not that you couldn't, but it's not necessarily a document of academic study or as a kind of artistic artifact of a particular discipline like writing.
Yeah, it won't be anthologized.
It won't be anthologized. Right. So, you know, there's, because I am pursuing what one might call the literary fiction route, and I'm not even comfortable with that term, I sometimes feel like I move in this culture or I'm in a community that tries to separate highbrow from lowbrow. And when I grew up, I liked what might be called lowbrow things.
It's okay. You're acting like you're ashamed of it.
I want to celebrate and receive your confession. But so a show like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, it's very entertaining, but it's also smartly written. And what I like about Buffy the Vampire Slayer, or even like comic books for that matter, when they're well done, they transcend their own subject matter. So much of the show Buffy the Vampire Slayer worked with the idea of monsters and vampires on a metaphorical level. High school, you know, if you read interviews with Joss Whedon, who created Buffy, his whole take was high school is hell. So I'm going to actually manifest demons and hell to show that high school really is a troubling thing. So it's a little tongue-in-cheek, but if you get invested into the narrative enough, it can actually become quite moving. And I feel like my relationship to that kind of material helps me with my work, so that when I'm writing a story about the making of a really bad monster movie, it might be easy enough to laugh at that. Mm-hmm. But and I understand that, and I kind of laugh at them too. But as I said before, my real job is to find the seriousness in that, is to give these people, these individuals who might have what we might find as, you know, silly goals, to give them humanity and to give them dignity. So I need to find what is serious underneath the whimsical or
yeah,
the silly.
Yeah, because the story, Monstrous, is so much deeper than just these bad monster movies
right.
that are being made. I mean, those characters, they're really alive and they really resonate. So yeah, so there's the influence of a well-written sort of cheesy TV show.
Yeah.
Okay. So how about The Carpenters?
The Carpenters.
You're going to have to tell some of these folks. They are way too young to know who The Carpenters are.
The Carpenters. I don't know. Show of hands, who remembers The Carpenters? Okay, enough people.
All right.
So The Carpenters were a brother and sister pop duo from late 60s, early to mid 70s.
Yeah.
And they were known for being very white bread and cheesy, especially in a time of a lot of, you know, social and political upheaval. They were just seen as, you know, just a little too squeaky clean for the culture
at
the time.
They absolutely ruined the Beatles' song, Help.
They kind of ruined it.
All right. Go ahead. Defend it if you care.
I prefer the Beatles version.
All right.
I think they did ruin it, now that I think about it. It's Ticket to Ride. Is it Ticket to Ride that they ruined?
Well, I think they ruined Help. But you.
Okay. We'll discuss later.
Yeah. We'll play it backwards.
The Carpenters were like this cheesy band. But if you know Karen Carpenter's story, she had a very tragic life. She died of anorexia. She was anorexic and she died. And that's what really got the idea of anorexia into the national conversation. That was a real problem with young women. So when you listen to what might seem like these cheesy, overly joyful songs, Karen Carpenter's voice and the tenor of her voice really relays a kind of ache. And that's a really interesting juxtaposition, because here's this kind of bouncy, happy music that you can just sort of bop your head along to. But if you really stop and listen to her voice, so it's not just what she's singing or what she's saying, it's how she's saying it. It's that voice that she's using to express these lyrics that give it a sense of irony, of a multi-layeredness. And there's one song in particular, it's a song called Top of the World, which is a very bouncy, happy song. But there's this one line it's this line, something, something, that tomorrow will be just the same for you and me. It's a very cheesy rhyme, you know, A-B rhyme scheme. Mm-hmm. But it's the way she sings the word same. Like, if you really stop and just listen, when she sings the word same, I detect just this very quiet desperation and sadness. It's almost like a plea. Hmm. And I'm not saying she meant that consciously, but she just possesses this kind of quality to her voice. And I like the fact that on the surface you have something that seems maybe shallowly joyful, but underneath is this layer of is a life of sadness.
Yeah, and there's a real melancholy to her voice.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think I'm trying to do that with some of what I'm writing about.
That's a great explanation.
Yeah.
Okay. I do buy it. And okay. I have a couple of their albums.
Yeah, I have their greatest hits.
I may go home and
yeah, listen to that.
And have a good cry.
Okay. Okay,
all
good.
Right. All right.
I'll join you.
Yeah. So you grew up with this sense. Your parents were adults when they moved to the United States. But you grew up with this sense that they were glad to be in America, but they longed to be back in the Philippines. Is that accurate?
I don't know if they longed to be back in the Philippines. I know they missed I know my mother especially, I think, missed, because her siblings were there.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was always a sense of home being two places. So when she would take trips to the Philippines, in Tagalog, she would say, "I'm going home." And so I was always very conscious of that because, as far as I knew, I only had one home, and I still only have one home. America mm-hmm. is my home. So I definitely noticed that distinction. And I think I sometimes wondered if it was necessary for a person to pick one, if you had to just have one home. And I think that's become I always tell my students, you know, if you can't figure out what you want to write about, ask yourself, what are you obsessed with? And I think just one of the obsessions I've had growing up, not even just as a writer, but as a human being, is what does home mean? Where are you your truest self? I always imagine that's where home should be. And I think part of that might come from the fact that my parents referred to the Philippines and to America as home.
Both places.
Yeah.
Because there's a quote in your story, The I Hotel.
Okay.
That I want to read you this quote from it, that I just wondered if you were really talking about your own experience or your family's experience. And this is, Save the I Hotel.
Save the I Hotel.
Okay. Nobody knows you're here, just the work you do, just the color of your face. They called America a mistake, and now the dream was to find a way back home to the life you knew and the person you were. I wondered, are you talking about like the generations of people that you kind of grew up around when you make a quote like that? I realize it's a fiction quote,
yeah.
and it's a character who's talking. Mm-hmm. But I just wondered how much that actually resonated with your own experience or what you were hearing when you were growing up.
I think I certainly heard the sentiment from many immigrants. And that doesn't necessarily mean I was related to them. Even just sometimes hopping into a cab. I remember my first time in New York City, I got into a taxi cab, and the fellow who was driving the taxi was from Colombia, and he was explaining to me that in Colombia he was a lawyer, but here he was a cab driver. And I think he'd said something about, you know, at this point I'm just trying to save up so I can go back home.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if I was necessarily referencing him, but I think I was referencing that, what I feel is a true phenomenon for some people,
yeah,
not everybody, but for those particular characters in that story, that's how some of them were understanding their new life.
I'm glad to hear that, because I wondered if that was your view of this is every immigrant's experience or mm-hmm. every immigrant's kind of sense that this is home.
Mm-hmm.
They're glad to be here, but they long, like the cab driver,
mm-hmm.
they long to be in Colombia. They mm-hmm. long to be in Mexico. They long to be in China.
Yeah.
And so I was just wondering if what you were talking about was actually every immigrant's experience, but you're saying not necessarily.
No. I would never offer that as a blanket statement. And you know, when I hear that quote, I'm very much, it's anchored in the experience of some of those characters.
Got it.
But certainly not, it's not meant to be representational
okay.
in the real world.
It also seems like your characters in your stories start out with really high expectations.
Yeah.
Really high. And their lives never live up to those expectations.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of the core of a lot of your story is that tension of, not your story, the stories that you've got in here, is that tension between this is what I was expecting, but this is what I got.
Yeah.
And that their circumstances, their choices pull them back down. Mm-hmm. Is that a fair assessment of many of the main characters in your stories?
Yes.
How come?
Because, the root of all good narrative is conflict. If you're not a writer who, or a fiction writer, let's say, who is interested in conflict or trouble, it'll be very hard to write a good story. Nobody wants to read about a story about a couple who goes on a picnic and has a perfectly lovely day, and the sun is out, there are no ants, and they enjoy their meal, they end up engaged, and they get married and live happily ever after. That would be the most boring story of all time. We may want to live that, but we don't want to read that. We want to read about trouble. So,
in fact, I've heard the line, only trouble is interesting.
That's true. Only trouble is interesting in fiction.
Yeah,
maybe
we
don't want it in life. But we want it in what we read.
Okay.
And so because that is, I agree with you, I think that's a common thread in these stories. I think it's an inherent conflict for some of the characters that I'm dealing with. A story has to have stakes. If characters dream big from the very beginning, the stakes are automatically high. And there's something that is hopefully worth fighting for, and hopefully worth a reader exploring page after page after page. So they have to begin with that kind of trouble. They have to have these high expectations. And I certainly don't mean to play it as though moving from one land to another is a bad thing. Because I don't think it's a bad thing. I don't think as I said earlier, nothing is purely good, nothing is purely bad. So for all the success some of these characters might have, whether it be personally or professionally or artistically, there are many losses on the way. And for everything that they might have lost, there are things that are also gained. But of course, I do think there's a lot of disappointment in this book.
Yeah, well, and that was going to be my next question. Do you actually think this is what life is like? Is that you start out as a kid watching Buffy the Vampire Slayer or listening to The Carpenters, and you think, you know, life is just awesome, and then the older you get and choices you make or circumstances... I was just wondering if maybe this was sort of a world view of yours that was kind of coming through.
You know, I don't think I grew up thinking everything's great. Life is just meant to be one big happy dream. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't think I was a morose kid, but I do think I was a suspicious kid. I think for a young person, I did have a degree of cynicism. I think I assumed people had, this will make me sound paranoid, but I assumed that some people had ulterior motives or whatever they might be saying, there could be another meaning to it. Hmm. And I think that, you know, no one's ever asked me this, but I would say that's that kind of worldview started when I was a young person. Yeah. And there's no, like, defining tragedy that happened
no.
to me, but I think I just kind of was suspicious.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, so let me take it a step further. Many of your characters also seem to be kind of on the outside of things looking in.
Yeah.
Like, there's an inside story going on here, and I'm not a part of it.
Mm-hmm.
Is that kind of how you experienced life also?
I don't think I grew up as a kind of outsider. I was a fairly mainstream kid, I would say. I mean, I had friends in high school. I wasn't, you know, the most popular kid by any means, but, you know, I had my friends, and I did a lot of normal, whatever you might want to call normal kid stuff or teenage stuff. But the idea of the outsider is interesting to me in fiction, because I think they tend to observe, and they tend to maybe critique. I think the challenge is to make sure that they're not passive, that at some point they have to act. Mm-hmm. And I think when an outsider finally decides to make a decision or to take action because of their position in life or in the universe, those stakes are very high. Someone who exists on the outside of things, if they decide to actually take a step in and act, there's a lot riding on that. On that action or on that gesture. And so I think that's what a lot of these characters I think, are doing.
Well, and the reason it so resonated with me, all of these, is that I think that's everybody's experience, maybe secretly. There's a real universal thing that we all think maybe something else is going on here, and we just haven't been clued in, or nobody told us the secret.
Yeah.
You know, everybody else knows the secret, but we don't. Yeah. And so that isn't just an immigrant's experience.
Right. Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah,
I think that's kind of universal. We all suspect that.
I would think at some point in everybody's life, everyone has felt like an outsider at some point. And if a person hasn't, I would think that person is incredibly boring. You know, to always be fully immersed in the mainstream all the time, to be in perfect harmony with what everyone else is doing at every living moment. I mean, I don't know how you develop any sense of self-awareness or any sense of suspicion or doubt that you kind of need to survive.
Yeah.
I would think.
Good. You know, this goes into a deeper thing about just writing fiction. You've talked about discovering the emotional truth in fiction. And I think I know what you mean, but I'd love to hear what you think it means. What does that even mean, to discover the emotional truth when you're writing fiction?
I think if I say the emotional truth, I'm not thinking factually. I'm thinking about the fact, probably, that there is no one universal truth. So, for example, when someone asks me, or when someone points out, you know, your stories are funny, does it take a long time to develop humor in the work? And I don't really think about developing humor in the work. I think about what is emotionally true in the moment. So you may have a very silly moment in a story where a woman puts on a wolf mask, thinks she's about to receive a beautiful present from her boyfriend or her lover, and she opens it up and it's a wolf mask. And he says, "I want you to star as the creature in my movie." That, I understand that is a funny moment, but for these characters, it's actually true. So when she puts it on, the truth is, it's a funny moment, but to her, it's tragic. She's thinking that, "I thought he was going to give me a really meaningful, beautiful gift that would be some symbol of love. Instead, he's given me this ridiculous costume that he wants me to put on." So there's humor
from
in
him.
That.
He's saying, "I want you in my movie."
Right. So it's not, that's not a moment of me thinking, "I got to make this a funny scene." Mm-hmm. Because humor in fiction it's not a joke. Humor is actually just another side of the truth. So the humor in that moment is truthful to these characters. Okay. To another person, that moment is tragic because you see all her dreams being dashed. So to me, that's what emotional truth is. It's many different kinds of truth competing with each other. And I think that's where you get tension. If it were purely funny, you'd just have a joke. If it were purely tragic or sad, you have nothing but pathos. And that kind of single note in fiction is too flat. I don't think it'll work.
Let's talk about some of your specific stories. I'm thinking Super Assassin. This was the one. Is this the first one you got in the Atlantic?
Yeah, that was the first story I ever sold.
Super Assassin. I think here's a kid who wants to take on some of the qualities of a superhero.
Yeah.
Right? Because he's being bullied and because some stuff is happening to him that just isn't fair.
Yeah.
I just think that's one of those. I can't speak for everybody, but I think a lot of people would resonate with this, just thinking, well, of course. I mean, somebody who could take on some kind of qualities to settle scores, you know, to end bullying, whatever. But then I got to thinking, what were the superhero qualities when you were little that you would have loved to have had?
What superhero qualities? Like powers?
Yeah. I mean, this guy, he's got the ability to really make other people's lives miserable.
Right. Oh, I probably had that ability a couple times in my life.
Was there a certain superhero that you wished you were?
I liked the Green Lantern when I was a little kid.
The
power ring where you can create. I mean, because the whole, if you know the Green Lantern story, the only limit is the imagination. He can conjure anything with that magical ring. Mm-hmm. He's only limited by his imagination and his own will, his willpower. I always thought that idea was very cool, that the only true limits you have are within you. So I liked that idea very much. But I think You know, I wasn't a brave kid. I was a kid who kind of, I think I kind of scared easily. You know, I wasn't very athletic and I didn't get into fights. I wasn't very tough. So I think, and I can certainly remember moments, you know, when you're play acting as a kid, pretending you're a superhero. It's fun and you want to embody all those things that you in your real life cannot. And I'm not saying that was my thought process at the time of imagining myself in these superhero scenarios, but I did understand that superheroes were these extremes of qualities that I didn't really possess naturally.
But made it so easy for you to tap into as a character.
Yeah.
In this story. I mean, here's a kid who had those same desires and to a certain degree was able to pull it off.
Yeah, for better or for worse. But yeah
exactly. It didn't work out completely well
right.
for him.
He's a troubled kid.
So then the story Lemoore, California, which, oh my gosh, the Issa character, she thinks they're moving to a city that means, a city called Lemoore, that means in French, love.
Yes.
She thinks that's where they're moving to. But the name is really Lemoore, L-E-M-O-O-R-E.
Yeah.
And right off the bat, it's just, she's disappointed. It's just another crappy town.
Yeah.
Right? That's one of those, this just struck me as so much, so realistic of a kid's expectation. Mm-hmm. A kid gets kind of worked up over Christmas or, you know, something, and then realizes, oh, no. So I just, even though I've never been a little girl, and I've never moved to a little crappy town in Central California, I really resonated with that character.
Oh, glad. Well, it took a long time. That story, I worked on other things, you know, in the meantime, of course, but that story, it took me over 10 years to get that story right. I worked
really?
On other things. Yeah. I wrote early drafts in graduate school, and I felt like I was always really close to getting it done, but I could never get it right, and so I would put it away. I'd pick it up 2 years later and think, oh, maybe I can do something with this. I'd work on it, couldn't get it right, put it away. And normally when I do that, I just throw the story away. And I've certainly written stories that I finish, and ultimately, if they don't work, they don't work, and I toss it. But I cared about that story. And if I cared about it, I knew I had to keep working on it. And so one day I was working on that story, and I was thinking, you know, maybe it needs a new beginning. How do I start this? They're moving to Lemoore. And I was just saying Lemoore to myself, and I realized Lemoore, and I don't even speak French, but Lemoore, Lemoore, they sound the same. That means love. And Issa is a girl who dreams of love. She dreams of you know, sweeping romances and things like that. She's a teenage girl. Not that all teenage girls think that way, but she's that kind of teenage girl. And so I thought, if she thinks she's moving to a city that's named for the French word for love, then she thinks, oh, that's my destiny. That's where I want to be. And so what a letdown when she sees, oh, it's called Lemoore, and she doesn't know what that means.
Right. But then she has the identical experience with a boy where she thinks this is what love is.
Oh, right. Yeah.
She has the same experience with the name of the town as she does with this relationship with this boy.
Right.
And that doesn't work out either.
Right, right.
Spoiler alert, I suppose, for those who
spoiler.
Haven't. Yeah. Oh, man.
Yeah.
What a story.
Thank you.
Oh,
it took a long
boy.
Time to write, so I was very, very happy when that story was taken. I felt like I could go to sleep for a while.
Yeah. And then in the story, Felix Starro, the character provides other Filipino-Americans hope.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That's one of the things I got out of that story. He was a fraud. He was a charlatan.
A scam artist.
Yeah, he was a scam artist. But you know what he reminded me of? He reminded me of a lot of these TV preachers who in sort of the present day. You know, they promise all sorts of stuff and people pay them well to keep providing them with false hope. So there's another one of those universals. This wasn't just about this scam artist coming from the Philippines.
Right. Right. And you know, I appreciate you saying universal, because I do think, I do want the book to appeal to people who may not have any experiences remotely close to what these characters are going through. But I mean, I think when you write, you have to It's an act of empathy. You have to try to find an emotional connection to characters who are vastly different from yourself. And even though these characters are Filipino or immigrants, it's not as though they're repeating experiences that I've had. I have very little in common with what these characters are going through, but I strive to create an empathetic connection with them so that hopefully any reader I'm lucky enough to have will develop that sense of empathy as well. So someone might recognize the universal truth of feeling misled or of being given false hope from a Felix Starrow-like figure mm-hmm. that they're aware of. Or, you know, I don't imagine many people who have read my book have been in a leper colony before, but maybe they understand what it's like, or they can relate what it's like to feel like an exile or to feel like you don't belong or to question what it means to be beautiful or worthy of love. Those are not questions that I'm consciously grappling with as I'm writing. I'm just trying to tell the story.
Yeah.
But it's draft after draft when I realize there's another story that exists here. One of the best pieces of advice I ever got from a teacher, and I repeated to my students, is that a story is not a story until it's at least two stories. It's that second story, that third story, that fourth story that I'm working to discover as I draft each one, so that hopefully if I'm lucky to have it published and if I'm lucky to have someone read it, I'm not giving them a document of absolute truth. I'm giving them a story that hopefully gives them an experience unlike any other reader's experience. Of course, there'll be overlap, of course.
This is really interesting. So a story isn't a story until it's two stories.
Mm-hmm.
So are we talking about layers? Are we talking about you could read it at this level and it's a metaphor for what's mm-hmm. much deeper? Is that what you're talking about?
That, but I'm also thinking that if one person were to give a summary, like say a thematic summary of one of these stories, mm-hmm. I would hope that I would hear different kinds of responses. So someone could read Super Assassin and say, oh, this is a story about bullying. Someone could also take that story and hopefully say, you know, this is a story about a neglected kid. Or this is a story about what happens when you feel as though you don't know where you belong.
Yeah.
Or this is a story about isolation and loneliness. Or someone might even say, this is a story about, you know, the dark side of art or identifying too much with a make-believe character. I would like to think that all those different mm-hmm. interpretations exist for a story like that.
So that's the multiple stories within the one story that you're referring to.
Yeah. Yeah.
You went back to the Philippines as an adult.
Twice. Yeah.
And it messed you up.
It
messed up your writing.
Oh, yeah. It had a very weird impact on my writing. It really did. I went back to the Philippines when I was 27 years old. My mother was there at the time, so I wanted to join her and just see what life was like for her and, you know, back in the tiny village where we were from. But I also thought, I was still working on this book, I thought it will be great research. You know, what an opportunity to have a family trip, but also to get some writing done. And so the 3 weeks I spent in this small village and the couple times we went into Manila, you know, I would sort of try to take everything in thinking, you know, all these facts, all these experiences are available to me right now. This is material. I've got to take it and somehow make use of it when I get back home. And when I got back home, I just felt so overwhelmed and stifled. I suddenly felt committed to rendering everything that I saw and trying to make a story out of what I was witnessing. But that's not really how I work. For the most part, I don't create stories based on what I necessarily witness or experience directly. I make stuff up.
In fact, you have said that the real world means less and less to you when you're writing.
Yeah. Yes.
So you're just going into your imagination.
I am. I think after that trip to the Philippines that I learned that, and I accepted that was how I write. But So I finally just kind of let it go, and I realized, you know, I had a good trip, but that trip was not about writing. It wasn't about gathering material. It was just to spend time with my family. But I did get one detail from that trip that made it into a story that was actually critical to understanding the story. So I was in the Philippines, and I was about to fly. I was flying back to the States, and I saw at the security checkpoint. A sign that said, no well-wishers beyond this point. And I thought, that's interesting. What if you don't wish them well? Can you keep going?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a story in here called Help, and the narrator's mother leaves to go to America, and he starts to chase after her, and the security guard pulls him back and points to the sign and says, the sign says, no well-wishers beyond this point. And he wants to say, but I don't wish her well. I want her to stay. And he feels so frustrated by that. And as it turns out, she leaves forever.
Mm-hmm.
And that really becomes the heart or the root of his conflict and his emotional trouble. And just getting that little detail into the story helped me build some of his life on the page.
Mm-hmm.
So I did take something from it. But it's a very small detail.
Yeah, and that was the story within the story. I mean, his conflict wasn't just, do I do what my uncle or whoever it was says I should do? Mm-hmm. It's this deeper thing of missing his mom.
Right. And that's maybe that's the second story. That's the third story. Yeah,
exactly. Now, your writing process has changed over the years. You used to be one of these just blasted out, 20 pages in a night, caffeine-fueled writing experience. You don't write that way anymore.
No.
How come?
I'm tired. Tired. I can't write until 4 in the morning anymore. I teach full-time, and that takes up a lot of time. And admittedly, I'm also more self-editing than I was before.
Is that a good thing?
It can be, but often it's not. Sometimes I just need to allow myself to be messy on the page, because you never know what material you might generate. But because I feel as though my time is so fractured now, I hesitate to devote a lot of free time to bad pages. But sometimes that's what you got to do.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not as fast as I used to be. But I mean, hopefully I'm a better writer.
Okay, so this is just maturity and life experience and circumstances.
Circumstances, yeah.
You're working on a novel now.
Yeah.
So you're a short story guy. So what's this like?
It's a whole different monster to tame. I hear some writers, I think I hear more students who tell me, you know, I'm going to write short stories and then I'll just move on to the novel.
Yeah.
And this idea of moving on seems to be like the next natural step as though the short story were somehow training ground.
Yeah, yeah,
and maybe
you're in the shallow end of the pool.
Right.
Right, right, right.
And maybe that's true for some. But for me, the short story has its own set of demands that the novel does not. So when I'm writing a short story, by virtue of the genre or the form, it's got to be short. So if I'm heading into 35 pages, I'm thinking this is getting too long, and also be harder to publish a story that long. So I'm working with compression, and I'm working to see how much mileage can I get out of one paragraph, out of one sentence, because it's got to do double, triple duty. With a novel, you have the luxury of space, but what is seemingly luxurious is also quite daunting, because now I'm writing a scene and I'm thinking, this scene has gone on for 7 pages. When does it end? Somebody end this madness now.
Mm-hmm.
So it's harder to feel tamed and controlled by the parameters of brevity when, you know, a novel can go as long as it wants. So I'm still trying to figure that trickiness out.
Yeah, so that's a whole nother mental discipline.
It is for me.
Yeah, because you've got these boundaries that you're used to, and now you don't.
Right, right. Absolutely.
And it's working so far? How well?
It's slow. I'm a slow writer. I really, really am. And I've been working on a novel for a couple years, and I took a sabbatical a couple years ago. I'm a full-time teacher, but I had sabbatical for a year. Took a year off from teaching, and I managed to write the first draft of a novel. It was a terrible draft, and I was fine with that. But after finishing the draft and sitting with it for a while, I had to accept that that's not the story I want to tell.
Hmm.
And I'm certainly not the first writer that has happened to. But nonetheless, it still bums you out. But now I'm back into the story, and it's a story that I not only understand better, but that I actually care about.
Cool. So what kind of advice would you give to writers? Old, whomever. They're not going to follow it, so just take your best shot.
Okay, let's see. Some advice. One bit of advice is that Being a storyteller is different than being a writer. So I'll meet people who say, I have a great story to tell, I should write a book. And the way I view that is, if you really want to write the book, if it's a story that must be written as opposed to told or as opposed to performed or staged, if it must be written, you really need to care about the process of writing. You have to, and it's not just a love for words. It's a love of sentences, and it's a love of paragraphs, and it's a love of the scene. It's a love of movement and flow of language and of event. It's work. It's a real discipline. It's a real craft. So I always make the distinction between being a storyteller. If you want to be a storyteller, pick up an acoustic guitar, build a fire, invite all your friends, bring beer, and tell your story. That's great. And that's a skill I wish I had.
And it's worthwhile.
Yeah, I wish I could do that. The kind of storytelling I do must be on the page. It must be written. So that's one thing. I don't know if that's advice so much as it is an observation that I believe to be true. Mm-hmm. If you are writing fiction, something I tell my students, and it always seems to devastate them for the first class, I always say, just because it happened to you doesn't mean it's interesting. And I know that can sound really brutal, but the reason I say that is because my students, especially my freshmen, will write these stories and will critique them as a group. And then will say, well, I didn't quite understand why, or I didn't believe it that there was, I don't know, a burglary on page 7. And then the student will say, well, that's how it happened. That's what really happened. So it has to be there. But that doesn't matter. What matters is the story. If you want to be a journalist, if you want to write nonfiction, great. But if you want to write fiction, what matters is the story, not what actually happened. And nothing, I believe this, nothing in life is inherently interesting. It's only the way it's presented that makes it interesting. A war is not inherently more interesting than this blue cup. The way I present the war to you is what can make it interesting. The way I can present this cup to you is what will make it interesting. But in and of itself, they're just events or they're just objects. And I know that can seem kind of mean and kind of brutal, but no. I feel like I need to get... It helps me figure out which of my students are really serious about writing fiction.
Well, you've made this really interesting. So thank you. Leslie Tenorio,
thank you
for being with us.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.